Thanks everyone for coming to my talk. So this talk has three parts. And in each part, I'm going to tell you about a distinct formulation of the problem of testing quantum states. And as I'll soon discuss, each of these has broader implications that I'll also talk about. So let me start with the first part, which is about testing matrix product states. So this is joint work with John Wright at UC Berkeley. And the setup is something that we are all familiar with. We have n qubits in some joint state given by a pure state psi. And this psi lives in this tensor product space. And it's either a product state or an entangled state. So we say psi is product if you can write it as a tensor product of n d-dimensional vectors. And if you can't do that, then we say psi is entangled. So given this, there are some natural questions we can ask, like given some state psi, whether it's entangled or product. And if it is entangled, how entangled is it? And just thinking about these questions has been fairly influential in our field. Starting famously with the Bell test and then quantum games. There has been applications in cryptography, complexity theory, and our understanding of the physics of quantum many-body systems. So in this talk, we're going to look at these questions from the perspective of statistical learning theory. And in particular, we are going to formalize this these questions by looking at the property testing model. So this is a model used often in learning theory to formalize what it means to test whether a set of objects have a specific property or not. So in our case, the set of objects we are working with are pure quantum states. And we are going to use this model to design an algorithm for testing entanglement. And this algorithm is going to get m iid copies of the pure state psi. And if psi has at most certain amount of entanglement, the algorithm accepts with high probability. And if psi is far from all states with at most that amount of entanglement that we fixed, then this test rejects with high probability. And these are the completeness and soundness properties of this test. And the goal is to find out what is the fewest number of copies m of this pure state psi that we need to design a reliable entanglement testing algorithm in this model. So there are two vague things about this that I need to clarify. The first one is, what do I mean by a state having certain amount of entanglement? And then how do we define the distance of a state psi to a set of other states? So let's just start with the first part of quantifying many-body entanglement. And the way that we are going to do this in our talk is using matrix product of states. So again, we have this n-qubit state psi. And we are going to look at all the reduced density matrices we get across the contiguous subsystems of this state. So we are looking at the first subsystem, the first two subsystems, and so on. And if all of these reduced density matrices had rank at most r, and rank here is the number of non-zero eigenvalues, then we say that this state is a matrix product state with bond dimension r. So in particular, if r equals 1, then you get the set of product states, and there is no entanglement. But turns out if you allow r to grow exponentially with n, the number of qubits, then in principle, any quantum state can be written as a matrix product state. So in this sense, bond dimension quantifies or limits the amount of entanglement in your state. If r equals 1, there is no entanglement. As you grow r, there is more and more entanglement. And turns out these states are also physically relevant. And many states that we care about in physics are indeed matrix product states of a small bond dimension. OK, so this is going to be our measure of entanglement. Now let me go back to this model, this property testing model. And we are going to be more specific. Now we want to design an algorithm for testing matrix product states. And again, this algorithm, when given sufficient number of copies, with high probability correctly decides if a state is matrix product state of bond dimension R, where R is fixed, or it's far from that. And by that, I mean either you look at the overlap, which is defined as the maximum overlap between your state psi and the set of MPS states, or you look at the trace distance. Now you can think of psi as a density matrix. And these two are simply related to each other, so I'm gonna switch back and forth between them. But I'll use delta to refer to trace distance. So when I say delta far, I mean in trace distance. And as before, the goal is to find out the smallest number of copies we need for this algorithm to reliably work, given a certain number of qubits, a fixed bond dimension, and some distance delta. So this is the setup. And now I'll tell you about the simplest case of this, where you want to test MPS with bond dimension equals 1. So this is testing whether your state is product or not. And then as you'll see, the intuition from this test can be used to design a general MPS. So this product test that I'll discuss is a two-copy test, meaning it takes two copies of a state psi and then outputs yes or no. But then I'll show you how you can boost its performance by repeating it a bunch of times to get back to this property testing model. So this two-copy test was first introduced by Minchard et al. And then analyzed by Hara and Montanaro. And its main ingredient is the swap test by Berman, Cleave, Vitras, and DeWolf. And as you hopefully know, the swap test is a two-outcome projective measurement where it either outputs accept or reject, and accept is when you measure the projector proportional to identity plus swap. So there is a simple calculation you can do to show that when you perform this on two states, psi and phi, this test accepts with a probability that relates to the overlap between your states. And this also goes through for mixed states, as well as when you have two copies of the same mixed state row. Then the acceptance probability relates to the purity of your state row. And if it's a pure state, then this always accepts. If it's a mixed state, then there is some probability of rejection. Okay, so let's take this swap test. And now we are going to use it to test whether some state psi is product or not. And as I mentioned, we have two copies of this. And the product test proceeds as follows. It measures every qubit and its copy with a swap test for all of the qubits. And then it accepts if and only if all of these swap tests accept. So that's the test. And you can make some immediate observations. The first one is that if you input product state to this test, it passes with probability 1. And the reason is what I mentioned before. If your state is indeed product, then any qubit and its subsystem forms a pure state. And when you perform the swap test on this, it just accepts. And this is true for all qubits. But maybe surprisingly, it turns out that if your state is delta far from being product, then this test rejects with probability delta squared. And to see intuitively why this is the case, we can again look at how swap test performs on each subsystem and its copy. And you know, if your state is far from being product, that means at least across some subsystems, it's going to give you a mixed state. And therefore, there is some chance for the swap tests across those subsystems to reject. If you do the calculation, it turns out this probability is delta squared. And then you can repeat this test, 1 over delta squared, many times to get to boost the performance to a constant probability as we need it in the property testing model that I mentioned. Okay, so this very simple test has surprising implications. In complexity theory. And it implies, in fact, that two complexity classes or a hierarchy of complexity classes are equivalent. So this is QMAK for k greater than 2 equals QMA2. So QMAK is the class of problems that a polynomial time quantum verifier can solve with the help of k provers that provide unentangled witnesses. So the verifier takes psi 1 tensor psi 2 tensor psi k as input and then runs a quantum circuit and is able to solve some problems using the advice or the witness from the provers. So this is QMAK. But it turns out you can simulate this process of having k distinct provers by only allowing two. And then running this product test on what the two provers give you to make sure that they're just tensor products. So there is no entanglement between psi 1 through psi k, which is the requirement of this class of problems. And just beyond this complexity theory equivalence, this QMAK equals QMA2 fact also has applications in proving hardness for certain classical optimization problems that when you first look at them, they don't necessarily have like a quantum flavor to them. And there is a list of almost 20 of these problems in the original Haro-Montanaro paper that you can look at. And you know, all of these hardness results come from the soundness of this simple product test. So it's been an open problem whether there exists a simple proof of this test, which also gives you improved performance. The original one by Haro and Montanaro is fairly elaborate, and is known not to be tight. So this is our first result. I'll first tell you how you can get an improved analysis of the product test, and then we bring this to the general case of MPS. And the proof is very simple. It's like it fits into one page. You can look at our paper. Here I'll give you a 1 minute summary of it. And the first thing we're going to do is to divide our n qdid state into two parts, the first subsystem versus the rest. And then you get this Schmidt decomposition in terms of these lambda coefficients. So these form a sorted non-increasing probability distribution. And they correspond to the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix on the first subsystem. OK, so let's take this as our input. And let's now suppose that the state psi is far from product. And we want to show that the product test rejects with a reasonable probability. Now, there are two cases. Either lambda 1, which is the largest of these Schmidt coefficients, is a small value. In which case, you can think of this as a, you know, these lambdas form a distribution. And if the largest one is a small, you can kind of intuitively think of it as a uniform distribution. And this kind of looks like a maximally entangled state. And this means that the first qdid is highly entangled with the rest. And therefore, the first swap test that we perform with high probability rejects. So in that case, we catch that this state is far from being product. If lambda 1 is large, then let's say it's very close to 1, then the first subsystem is not entangled with the rest. And therefore, the first swap test accepts. So it doesn't detect that this is not a product state. But because we know psi is far from product, that means it has to be that the first Schmidt vector on the rest, the remaining n minus 1 qdids, has to be far from product. And by induction, this means the remaining n minus 1 swap tests with high probability or with some probability detect this. So you can actually formalize this in this induction. And this gives you this expression you see for the probability of product test rejecting when the state psi is delta far from product. And it's, again, proportional to delta squared. But it also gives you the tight bound when delta, the distance, is known to be less than square root 1 over 2. So in this sense, this settles the analysis of product test, at least in this regime of delta. And now we are going to use this to go to MPS with bond dimension greater than or equal to 2. And I'll describe a test that has both upper and lower bound on its sample complexity, the number of samples it needs to operate. And let's go back to our definition of matrix product states. As I mentioned, all of these reduced density matrices must have a rank less than R for this state to be NPSR. So our test is going to simply check this. And the way we are going to do this to test the reduced density matrices have rank at most R is by using a generalization of the swap test by O'Donnell and Wright. And what they show is that they have an actually optimal algorithm, if the completeness is one, that given copies of a state rho determines if its rank is R or if that state is far from being rank R density matrix. And the number of copies it needs is R squared over epsilon. So this is the ingredient we're going to use. And our NPS tester simply runs this rank tester across all these contiguous cuts. And it will reject if any of these rank testers reject. So it's like, again, very simple test. And we can actually analyze its sample complexity, and we can show that the number of samples it needs is order n, where n is the number of qubits in your state. And the proof of this is also simple. It's based on the following two facts. The first one is that if rho is actually far from, the state psi is far from being NPSR, then there exists some subsystem, set of subsystems, such that the density matrix on those is also far from being rank R. But here you lose a factor of n. So if your state is constantly far globally from NPS, there exists a cut that rho is only 1 over n far. And that's why we get this order n in our sample complexity. But we actually don't know where this cut is. And that might be a problem because we are just blindly performing these rank testers. But there turns out that these different rank testers actually commute with each other. So they form, you know, a well-defined measurement. And the order in which they're applied doesn't matter for the analysis. So you can always assume that the first one is the one that is applied on the cut that is far, and it would detect that this is far from being NPS. So one striking thing about this upper bound is that, unlike product case, where we had a constant number of copies, here, even for R equals 2, like the least amount of entanglement you can think of, this test requires order n many copies. And you can ask if there is a way to improve this, to show that even for even R equals 2, a constant number of copies are sufficient for NPS testing. So we can show this for some special states that you can look at our paper to see them. But turns out, generally, this can't be done. And we have a lower bound. And our lower bound says any NPS tester, not our particular NPS tester, but any one that satisfies the completeness and soundness, requires square root n many copies. And the hard example where you actually need a square root many copies is this very simple state. So it's a tensor product of these two qubit states. You take phi and then you copy n half times. Let's say n is even. And this phi is chosen to be just barely far from NPS. So, you know, we can define NPS for n qubits, but we can also define it for two qubits. And this phi is a two-qubit state that is 1 over square root and far from being NPS. But although this is like really close to being NPS, when you tensor product it, the global state is constantly far from NPS. And that's problematic, because any NPS tester that wants to check whether this whole state psi is far from NPS somehow has to detect that individual phis are far from NPS. But they're really close to being NPS. So they need like square root n number of copies to be able to say that. OK, so in summary, in this part of the talk, I'll show you a simple test for testing whether a given state psi is product or not. And this test actually has been experimentally implemented. It's like a very simple test. It also has applications in complexity theory, as I mentioned. And then you kind of can get that and apply it to more general NPS testing. We don't have a tight bound on how many samples you need, but we have an upper bound of order n and a lower bound of a square root n. OK, so this was the first part of the talk. Are there any questions before I move on? Yeah.
So I think you said that the swap test can check the purity of a given mixed state, right? So when you talk about the product test, is the success probability just a function of the subsystem purities? Is that like a simple function of the subsystem purities?
Yeah, so the thing is that you're applying it n times, and then you need to take into account that not all subsystems are equally far from being pure. And the argument I mentioned kind of takes care of that. Once you have that, then yeah, it's just a function of the purity.
I guess what okay, maybe I can ask you later.
Okay, so let me move on to the second part. About testing some machine learning models of quantum states. And this is ongoing work with Robert Wong at Caltech. So the setup is the following. We again have an n-qubit quantum state psi. And suppose this is given in some fixed basis, let's say some standard basis x1 through xn. So this psi x1 through xn are just the amplitudes of this state in that basis. And now assume that we have some sort of representation of this quantum state that I'll denote by R throughout the talk. And it's a function that takes as input an n-bit string, x1 through xn, and then it outputs a complex number that up to a normalization factor is equal to the amplitudes of your state psi, such that if you want to find the ratios between the amplitudes of your state, you can just query this representation and find the ratios using that. So suppose we have some representation of our state that allows you query access to the amplitudes. That's the first assumption. And also assume that we have m copies of a potentially mixed state row. So this is also given to us. And our goal is to perform a few single qubit measurements on state row, as well as querying this representation of the pure state psi a few times, and then verify whether the overlap between psi and row is large. So this is what we want to achieve in this part of the talk. So this setup has some applications. Let me mention two of them. The first one is benchmarking quantum devices. So in this setting, now rho is prepared by a quantum device, and psi is the ideal state or the targeted state that we wanted the quantum device to prepare. And suppose we have access to the amplitudes of this ideal state, for example, by a direct simulation on a digital computer. By verifying that the overlap between psi and rho is large, we are verifying that the quantum device has prepared the right state. And it would be nice if you could do this even when psi is like a very complicated and entangled state. So then that means our device is capable of producing such complex states. So that was one setup. The other one is verifying machine learning models of quantum states. So now rho here is some unknown quantum state that we'd like to perform tomography on it and learn its description. And you can think of psi as some machine learning model for rho. So it's a parameterized state. It could be, for example, a tensor network. But it has to come with an efficient contraction method so that it gives us efficient access to the amplitudes. You can also think of this psi as one of the many recently introduced neural quantum states, that they also have this property that they give you efficient access to the amplitudes. That's how these models operate. And by verifying the overlap between psi and rho, we can check whether the state that a potentially heuristic method has learned by performing measurements on rho is actually a good representation or not. So like this verifies this heuristic machine learning models. And note that in the setup, the way I phrased it kind of rules out naive strategies. That, for example, could be perform full tomography on rho and then query your representation exponentially many times to get the full description of your state psi, and then compute their fidelity. So we don't want to do things like that just because they require exponentially many resources. What we want is something that only uses few measurements and few queries, and in general is like an efficient protocol. So let me describe the test that achieves this. And this has two parts. The first part has to deal with rho, and we're going to measure rho. So the way we measure it is that we choose one of the n qubits uniformly at random, and then we are going to perform the following measurements. We perform a z basis, like a standard basis measurement, on all the remaining n minus 1 qubits except qubit I. And then we are going to perform random x, y, or z basis measurements on the ith qubit. So let's call the outcome of the n minus 1 z basis measurements by a string z. So this is an n minus 1 long bit string. And let's call the state you get on the ith qubit after the measurements by ket s. So this is a two-dimensional vector. So let's take these two inputs, or outcomes, I guess, of measuring rho, and move to the second part of this test. Now we are going to query the representation of the state psi. So let's take that n minus 1 bit string from the last slide and pad it on the ith bit, either with the 0 or 1. Then we get z0 or z1, which are n bit strings because we added a bit on the missing location. And then we are going to query our representation with these two bit strings and form this two-dimensional vector v by just normalizing what we found. So this requires two query to the representation, and it gives us a two-dimensional vector. And then finally, we are going to report the overlap between this two-dimensional vector v that we obtained from our representation with some shifted and scaled up version of ket s, which was the post-measurement state on the ith qubit. So both s and v here are two-dimensional vectors. So here's the claim. The claim is that in expectation, an expectation is both over the choice of the random qubit I and the measurement outcomes. In expectation, if this local overlap between these two-dimensional vectors is large, then the global overlap between psi and rho is also large. And here we lose a factor of t, which turns out to be the mixing time of a certain random walk. It's actually inverse the spectral gap of that walk, but I'll just say mixing time. So what is this walk? This walk is being performed on the Boolean hypercube. So Boolean hypercube is a graph where each vertex is an n-bit string, and two vertices are connected if they only differ in one bit. And we are performing a walk on this graph by jumping from one vertex to a neighbor. And the probability of jumping can be computed only by the ratios of the amplitudes of the state psi. So this walk depends on our state psi. And turns out the way this walk is designed, the stationary distribution is going to be the absolute value squared of our amplitudes. So remember that these absolute values form a measurement distribution, and it corresponds to the distribution you get by measuring your state psi in the standard basis. So we have given a state psi, we can define this walk for it, and the time that it takes for the walk to kind of covers the whole graph, the mixing time, is going to determine the performance of our test. So for example, if you take your state psi to be this phase state, where the magnitude of your amplitudes are all the same, so they're all 1 over square root 2n, but then you have these complex phases, so this is like a family of quantum states, then the inverse spectral gap of the walk here is just order n. N is the number of qubits. But turns out, even if psi is a Haar random state, so a generic quantum state, which could be highly entangled, then the mixing time remains polynomial in the number of qubits. And this polynomial is nice if we believe it's order n squared. And more generally, we can show as long as this mixing time is polynomial, the sample complexity of this test that will verify the overlap remains polynomial. Yes?
Is it possible to think of this as, I mean, for constant depth circuits, you know, there's like a local Hamiltonian and you can measure it, and then, so for constant depth circuits, you wouldn't need to use this test, right?
Right, yeah, you just run the.
So is there a way of thinking about this as defining a sort of like non-local Hamiltonian, because you have the Z string. It's like a non-local Hamiltonian that tests in a similar way that a constant depth circuit can test?
Yeah, pretty much. So you can think of the Laplacian of this random walk as a Hermitian, it's a Hermitian operator. You can think of it as a Hamiltonian. Turns out for this walk that we designed, the ground state of that Hamiltonian is our potentially highly entangled state psi. And this measurement that we are performing that I described, these Pauli measurements, is as if you're measuring the energy of that Laplacian or this non, like weird Hamiltonian.
I see. Thanks.
So it's like very much what you described. So one thing is that, you know, this is kind of like a maybe counterintuitive argument that the mixing times over this exponentially large graph remain polynomial. So compare this to, for example, when you have a random walk on a grid or like on a line. In that case, the mixing time is polynomial in the number of vertices. And if the number of vertices is 2 to the n, then the mixing time is exponentially large. But somehow a hypercube is a very well-connected graph, and therefore the mixing times are substantially fast. And these measurements are using that fact that you can cover the hypercube fast to go from local overlaps to global overlaps. So there are other things that we can do with our test. We can actually get an end-to-end verification without having this promise on the mixing time. So there is like a way to kind of test that there the mixing time is polynomial, but I'll leave it here. So in summary, I describe a test that achieves this goal that I mentioned, that you can verify the overlap between a quantum state rho given in lab compared to a classical representation of a state psi. Okay, so that was the second part of the talk. Now let me move to the last part. Is there any question? Or?
So if you were to take rho as the output of a quantum supremacy experiment, and you could just interpret, you could reinterpret the data from the experiments that are already being done as measuring one qubit in the X basis by just applying a gate, an X gate at the end, right? You could just take the data that's already been generated by the quantum supremacy.
Yeah.
And then you could actually do your test after the fact using that data.
Yeah, yeah.
Like currently with some model psi that you could cook up.
Yeah, you could, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So the nice thing about this is that an experimentalist would go in lab, they would measure, and they would come back. So it's not online. Like the measurements are done. And then you can run our protocol and test if some represent classical representation of that we have is close to the state rho. And then there are other nice things you can do. Once you check that, then you can measure any sparse observable using directly this classical representation of psi using variational Monte Carlo. So this, for example, lets you measure entanglement using like Rényi entropies that originally requires exponentially many copies. But once you have this sort of efficient query access to the state rho, to the state psi, then you can find it efficiently. Okay, so let me move on to the last part. This is joint work with Anurag Anshu at Harvard and Aram Harrow at MIT. So the setup here is yet another way of thinking about testing quantum states. And we have Alice and Bob who share some pure state. And what they want to do is to test whether the state that they share equals some targeted state psi or not. So that's their goal. In other words, they want to perform these two outcome measurements. And they want to jointly collaborate to perform this measurement. And the way they're going to do this is they have access to unlimited EPR pairs. We grant that. And then Alice is going to apply some unitary operation on her side of EPR pairs, her share of the shared state, and some ancilla register. Then she's going to send this qubit to Bob, who would perform some other operation, and they have an exchange of these ancilla qubits. We say, okay, so the minimum number of exchange qubits that they would need to perform this two outcome test is the communication complexity of testing this bipartite state. That's our definition. And we even allow some epsilon approximation. So they don't have to get this perfectly, they can get it up to some epsilon error. And therefore, there is this index, the epsilon for the communication complexity. So in the rest of the talk, we'll be interested in testing certain families of quantum states. And these are ground states of local Hamiltonians. So we have a quantum antibody system, and we give one part of it to Alice, one part of it to Bob, and they want to test whether the state that they share is the ground state of a certain local Hamiltonian or not. And the way this is done is that, you know, if you look at the Hamiltonian of the whole system, part of the Hamiltonian is only acting on Alice's sides, part is only acting on Bob's sides, but there are also these boundary interactions that are presented by yellow here. And as before, we want to know what is the communication complexity of testing ground states. And in particular, I'm going to look at gapped ground states. And this is the case when there exists a constant energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state. And I assume, without lots of generality, that the ground state has energy zero. So if you have such a state, then there is, in general, besides the setup, a way to test whether a state psi is the ground state or not. And the ground state, I assume, is unique, by the way. You just measure the energy of that state. If it's much less than the gap, let's say gap over 2, then you output yes or accept, and otherwise you output no. And we also know...
So what if you don't know the energy is zero for the ground state?
Yeah, it doesn't matter for this test at all, this ground. But yeah, in general, yeah, you need to like, you need to know the energy difference, basically. But yeah, I'll get back to it. Okay, so we also know a test for measuring the energy, which is just the quantum phase estimation algorithm. So if you have sufficient number of ancilla qubits so that you can run this Hamiltonian simulation operator e to the ith, for t up to inverse of the gap, and then you repeat this procedure log 1 over epsilon many times, you can basically think of the phase estimation as a projector onto the ground state, or I guess as a two outcome measurement depending on the measurement outcome at the end. Okay, so this is kind of like the type of test we want to perform. The issue is that this state is shared between Alice and Bob. So neither has access to the full state to perform the phase estimation. And let's forget about the sharing the ancillas. What they have to do is to jointly perform the Hamiltonian simulation operator. And the number of qubits that they need to exchange to perform that determines the communication complexity that I talked about earlier. Okay, so now let me tell you how you could do that. And let's go back to this picture that, as I mentioned, the Hamiltonian terms are either local or there are some boundary terms. And if you just take the naive Hamiltonian simulation algorithms and, you know, forget about the two-party thing, just run a circuit, the depth of the circuit to implement the evolution with respect to the whole Hamiltonian scales as t, the time, times the norm of the whole Hamiltonian. And, you know, you can think of depth here as the communication cost, because it gives you the number of gates that cross the boundary. So Alice and Bob have to collaborate, exchange qubits, to be able to apply those gates that interact between, that apply to qubits shared between them. But the question is whether you can do better than this. And it turns out you can actually do this. And the intuition comes from the commuting case. So assume that this Hamiltonian that you have consists of mutually commuting terms. Then you can decompose your global time evolution into three parts. The first two are acting locally on Alice's and Bob's side. So for that, they don't need to communicate, they just apply. All they need to do is to implement this boundary evolution. And for that, they just use the algorithm in the previous slide. The complexity would be proportional to the norm of the boundary term, not the norm of the whole Hamiltonian. So that's the commuting case. But surprisingly, it turns out, and this is the work of Low and Weeb, that you can take this commuting case, the argument for the commuting case, and apply it more generally to non-commuting Hamiltonians. So I won't go through the details here. This is called interaction picture. I think it's well known in physics. But for a non-commuting Hamiltonian, you can decompose it similarly into two local terms on Alice's and Bob's side, and some other term, which has a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which relates to the boundary term by these unitaries on the left and right. So the details are not important here. Actually, the way I wrote this down is not quite correct. You need a time order operator, but like whatever. The main point is that this time-dependent Hamiltonian has a norm that is the same as, or is of the order of the norm of the boundary term. And it's time-dependent, but that also doesn't matter. So overall, you can basically implement this, or Alice and Bob can also implement this, by communicating only a number of qubits that scales with the size of the boundary. So now if you go back to this picture we had, they can actually implement the quantum phase estimation algorithm using a communication cost that scales with the size of the boundary, and by that I mean the number of Hamiltonian terms that cross, times inverse gap. And because we allow them to have some error, then there's a log 1 over epsilon error dependency that doesn't quite matter. So there is some other there are some other subtleties here that, you know, they also share EPR pairs, so they can use that to do better than normal Hamiltonian simulation algorithms, because in those settings you don't have EPR pairs, but I'll skip those. So in summary, this test that I described gives you an upper bound on the communication complexity that you need. So remember, communication complexity is the minimum number of qubits you need. I gave you a protocol that achieves some cost proportional to the boundary. And this turns out to have a very nice implication. And that's because we also know an interesting lower bound on this communication complexity. And it's a work of Hayden and Mitter, and then Kudron and Harrow, and Harrow and Leung, and also we have a version of it in our paper that shows communication complexity, the minimum number of exchange qubits, for some state psi is lower bounded by a quantity that depends on psi, and it's called entanglement spread. So what is entanglement spread? Let's go back to the setup we had. And notice that by applying local unitaries, nothing changes here. So without loss of generality, I assume that the state that they share is in the Schmidt form. So as we had earlier in the first part of the talk, these lambda coefficients are the eigenvalues of the reduced state either on Alice's or Bob's side. And they form a sorted distribution. So this is one example. And there are two quantities here that are important. Lambda 1 is the maximum of these eigenvalues, and R, or rank, is the number of non-zero eigenvalues you get. So take these two quantities, multiply them, and take their log. This gives you entanglement spread. So entanglement spread of a state psi only depends basically on its reduced density matrix, because we only work with these eigenvalues. And it also has an information theoretic interpretation. It's the difference between the max and mean Rayne entropy, for those who know what these are. But you can also more intuitively think of it as the log of the ratio between lambda 1, the maximum eigenvalue, over lambda r, the minimum. And hopefully this gives you intuition why this is called entanglement spread. If lambda 1 and lambda r are equal to each other, then we have a fairly concentrated distribution. There is no spread. If lambda 1 and lambda r are far from each other, then this is like a well-spread distribution. And you can actually do examples, like if you have a product estate, so if Alice and Bob share a product estate, then there is only one non-zero lambda coefficient. There is no spread. If you have a maximally entangled estate shared between them, then despite this figure that you have a spread out distribution, all of these lambdas are still equal to the same value. So still there is no spread, even for maximally entangled state. So this is different from entanglement entropy, which is another, you know, information theoretic quantity depending on that, those lambdas. Because in that case, maximally entangled state has a huge entropy, but it doesn't have a spread. But if you have a more exotic case, which is a superposition of the two previous cases, so half of, you know, a superposition of a product state and a maximally entangled state, then you get this bimodal distribution where half of your weight is on lambda 1 equals 1 half, and then the rest is on a much smaller value, which is 1 over 2 to the size of the smaller register, which I assume is Alice's register. In this case, entanglement spread is quite large, and it's actually the largest it could be. Okay, so what we showed is that there exists an upper bound on the communication complexity, and combining it with this known lower bound on entanglement spread, on communication complexity in terms of entanglement spread, overall we get this bound on the entanglement spread of a gapped ground state. So this says that entanglement spread obeys an area law for these gapped ground states. And you can compare this to the much more well-known area law, which says that the entropy obeys an upper bound that scales with the size of the boundary. So one nice thing about our result is that it applies to any interaction graph. So it doesn't have to be like a lattice, like a 1D or 2D lattice. It could be like any general like graph you have, as long as you have a local Hamiltonian, it's gapped, and it has a unique ground state, this universal bound on entanglement spread works. Okay, so I think I am done here. I told you about three different ways to formulate this problem of testing quantum states, and hopefully you saw that each one has interesting connections to other problems in complexity theory, in many body physics, and in learning or benchmarking quantum devices. So with that, I thank you for your attention.
You mentioned that when you pair like maybe ground state for the part. If we have a degenerate ground state, what's the?
Yeah, we actually don't know. So this does. Yeah, this uses the fact that you have a unique ground state.
Okay. So when you do this interaction picture evolution, you trotterize. Is that right? Or
You could trotterize.
When you talk about the communication scenario, you have a certain number of gates that cross the boundary. So,
right.
So, like in your paper, do you actually decompose it into a circuit and trotterize, or how do you?
Yeah, we actually use LCU, like linear combination of unitaries, instead of trotterization.
Okay.
And then we use these EPR pairs that are shared to improve the naive LCU.
But if you did trotterize, would you get the same number of gates crossing the boundary?
I don't think so. Or at least, I don't think we know that.
I see.
Any other questions? Oh, no questions. So about the inequality, that this entanglement spread depends on epsilon?
Sorry, say that again?
That this entanglement spread depends on epsilon?
Oh yeah, so I kind of like didn't talk about that, but yeah, so when you're defining this quantity, you basically, it's not a robust quantity the way I defined it, for the simple reason that you can take a little bit from the lambda 1 and distribute it all over to increase r, and that blows up this entanglement spread. But we know that's not important because it's just a small perturbation, like you can find a state close to it that has bounded spread. So to get rid of that, the definition of entanglement spread allows you to remove up to epsilon mass for from anywhere in the distribution. And then you get this factor of epsilon on both sides. So there is like this entanglement spread also needs like an index epsilon, which I.
And it's also the dimensional aspect is log epsilon thing.
I mean, the entanglement spread is just defined for an epsilon. But then the nice thing is that the dependency on epsilon is logarithmic, which is not bad.
Okay, this then I give you.